audio is a recording of the session Defeating Fracking, Setting Limits to Growth, the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair 2014. It looks at the growing opposition to the fracking movement in Ireland and the speakers from that movement, before the Worker Solidarity Movement's Paul Bowman looks at alternatives to the politics of jobs and growth, including those of degrowth and other anti-productivist meeting movements. You'll find more audio from the Anarchist Book Fair at www.wsm.ie/bookfair.
Paul was going to sit here and turn it on, but we got thrown by the exciting edition of the newspaper. So. Right, we're going. And you can either stand, speakers can either stand at the rostrum or stay sitting. So, So Leigh Doherty.
Thank you. Thanks, Will. I live in Roscommon. I'm just on the Leitrim border, just outside Carrick and Shannon. And 3 years ago, around our area, we had an idea, and we heard that there was some form of gas extraction. There was a gas find a number of years back. And about 3 years ago, we've got a mobile cinema in Leitrim. It's a little bus, and it drives around from town to town. And so basically about 3 years ago, this little mobile cinema was in Drumshambo, and they were showing a film called Gaslands. And myself and many other people went, and we discovered that night through a movie what was being proposed for the northwest of Ireland and the southwest. The movie was made by Josh Fox, an American guy who basically was actually a drama student, and he got a letter through his door basically asking for him to lease his land to a fracking company. So he investigated what this was about, and he toured around the States to basically where it was happening. And he made a pretty amazing documentary. I don't know how many people have seen Gasland. 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. So, you know, it was a serious starting point. And from that night there and then, we realised that this is what was being proposed. And there was no other debate, no other conversation, nothing else going on in Ireland that was informing us about it. So very quickly after that, we started having meetings in the area, and because we found out then through the government department that the licensed area was from Fermanagh all the way down to Limerick, and it was licensed for parts of 12 counties. So it was huge. This was going to be the single biggest industrial project this country has ever seen, if allowed to go ahead. So meetings started happening. People were coming from all over, spread out throughout the country. So we thought best that individual groups were set up in various different areas, because it just couldn't possibly have one group to cover the amount of ground and all the rest. So that's what has happened. We've got groups in Fermanagh, we've got groups, a group in Cork, there's a group in Galway, Leitrim, Roscommon, Mayo, Donegal. So, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of people working in this campaign, but as you know, if anyone has been involved in the campaign, there's a few core people in each area, and they're kind of doing the work. So basically, for anyone who doesn't know what fracking is, fracking came into play about 10 years ago in the States by a company called Halliburton. Halliburton is owned by Dick Cheney, and they basically discovered that before these deposits of gas, shale gas, that could not be extracted, could now be extracted through this process, which is where, with shale gas, it's not like a conventional well where you drill down one well and all the oil or the gas comes up, like offshore drilling or just conventional drilling onshore. This is a process whereby you have a pad the size on average of a football pitch, and on that pad you've got up to 24 wells, and each well is drilled down through the aquifer and down to the shale rock. And when it's drilled down there, because of the nature of shale gas, which is spread throughout the geology, they have to make cracks throughout the shale rock. So each well that's drilled, there's a spider of pipes that run in all directions through the shale rock, and they can run those pipes for up to a mile in each direction. So each of those wells on each well pad can run up to a mile. So it's a massive kind of construction in itself. And then the ground is blasted with small little blasts to crack the rock, and then the gas flows to the surface back up. So because of the nature of it, the pockets of gas are spread so widely, that one pad will more than likely be met with another pad just a few kilometres away. So anyone who looks at, let's say, North Dakota as an example, or Pennsylvania, where fracking takes place, you'll see that to make it economically viable to get enough gas out to drill, you have to do it extensively. There's no other way of doing it to be able to get the amount of gas that you need. So what has been proposed for North Leitrim alone is in around 100 to 150 pads. And each of those, as I say, would probably be in a square mile, kilometre or a mile from each other. So that's the size, the industrial size of it. And then in the process, then they inject a cocktail of fluids down into the borehole. And this, of course, is one of the very bad aspects of fracking. These fluids are highly toxic, and they most of it, 50% of it, remains underground. That's injected with water, and that water is then absolutely unusable and cannot be cleaned to put back into the water system. 50% of it comes back up. It's called wastewater, and that has to be disposed of. They haven't found a way of disposing of it. How can you dispose of water like that? That is highly toxic, radioactive, has drilling mud in it, has all of these toxic chemicals that they use, plus also because of the drilling, then they're mobilising the naturally occurring chemicals that are down in the ground, and that's coming up with the fluid as well, various heavy minerals and radioactive material. So that's another aspect of it. So what they do in the States is they have injected that fluid down into wells, injection wells, for storage, because there's nowhere they can get rid of it. And what the scientists, and there's a study just came out in the last number of days actually, that is probably what's causing a lot of the seismic activity in places like Ohio and that at the moment, because of the highly volatile nature of the fluid. It's actually causing seismic activity after it's injected into the ground. In other places in the States, what they do is they actually just spray it over roads and land to get rid of it. You know, so basically that's how we found out about fracking. These groups were formed, and that's 3 years ago. And since then, we have been tirelessly working and trying to inform people about this, because there is little or no national debate on the issue. Even though this, as I said, would be the single biggest industrial project, and of course energy project, but industrial project as on its own, that this country would ever have. So we have managed, through all the various groups that have been put in place, we've managed to inform the local people, mostly Fermanagh, Leitrim and Clare. And in those counties, we gave presentations to county councils, and we managed to get the county councils in five areas, in five counties, to call on our government to ban fracking. So each council passed a motion that they were calling on the government to ban fracking. TDs I've spoken to don't even know that, you know. So, I mean, that hasn't been reported at all, really. Literally 2 months ago in Leitrim County Council, we lobbied and extensively campaigned for the ban to bring it slightly further to be inserted into the county development plan. We knew that, you know, this action would not stop it, but it would be the best and the only thing that Leitrim County Council could do on our behalf. So, because it's election time, because we campaigned fiercely and our campaign was around no ban, no vote, and we said that we would name and shame the councillors that did not support us, we managed to get 17 out of 23 county councillors in Leitrim County Council to support our call for a ban to be inserted into the county development plan. So we got that, and that's in a draft plan now. Just yesterday was the final closing day for submissions to the county council to uphold that ban and for it to go into the final development plan. We're being told that legally, on one side, we're being told by kind of solicitors who've worked for the government that that's actually illegal, that, you know, the county council cannot impose this ban through a development plan. Other solicitors have told us that it's absolutely fine, that they can. There's no actual government policy yet because we're waiting on an EPA report from our government at the moment with regards to fracking. So that was a pretty major achievement by the campaign down there. And Sligo, Donegal and Clare have looked at that and have seen what we've done. And there are people now campaigning in Sligo, Clare and Donegal to do the same. So that's where it stands in Leitrim. And in the other counties, the county councillors have just called for a ban. They haven't inserted it into their development plan yet. And we're hoping that that ban that the 17 councillors put into the development plan will be upheld. We have a feeling that they're going to try and do something and say for legal reasons that it can't be. When the county council were voting on this, the night that they were voting on it, the county manager, I was in the council chamber at the time, and the county manager told the councillors several times during the evening that if they supported this ban going into the development plan, that they would personally be liable for any costs incurred from losses from the company not being allowed to come to County Leitrim, which was insane. It was basically a threat which had no legal standing. And one of the councillors, actually, who's a solicitor, he's a Fianna Fáil councillor, actually said that on record in the council meeting that night. He said, "I don't understand why the county manager is saying this, how he can say it," but he continued to say it. So that was the level of kind of the strength behind the county council officials who were adamant not to allow this to go ahead. And anyway, the councillors thankfully ignored it. And despite the fact as well that Fine Gael councillors that evening as well had also unfortunately been working with some people involved in our campaign as well, from a group called Love Leitrim and Good Energies Alliance, and they had basically been working alongside with them to put in a different version into the development plan, which did not call for a ban, but said, you know, there are EU laws that we have to uphold and all the rest. So I suppose going on from here, we're looking really now at Fermanagh and the North. Because we're waiting on the EPA report here to come out in 2015, the government said they're not going to do anything until that EPA report comes out. We know that that report will be just a rubber stamping, and it will basically be saying that there are regulations that need to be put in place. If they're put in place, fracking will be safe and it can go ahead. This doesn't take into account the fact that there has been no full life cycle health report from the US on fracking yet. It doesn't exist. So you cannot say that it is safe. There has been several research reports on the health impact, on the climate impact, on the impact on sustainable industries in an area where it takes place, on the industrialisation, But these are all research studies that are basically being ignored at present. And so this EPA report that's coming out by the government, it cannot say, even though they will argue that they can say it can be regulated and done safely. So we're waiting on that report, but in the north, they're not waiting on that report, even though they're involved in it. And so Fermanagh and Antrim are the two hotspots in Ireland at the moment as to where fracking will, if it does get the go-ahead, that's where it will start. So we're really working alongside the people in the north at the minute. Sinn Féin or the Unionist Party right now in the north could tomorrow morning veto fracking from going ahead. And we have been lobbying Sinn Féin ferociously. And in fact, you know, down the south here, they have called for a ban at the Rardesh. They have stated that they're very much against it. Michael Colreevy, the TD from Leitrim, Sinn Féin TD, has said it's something he would go to jail over. But yet in the north, they could stop it tomorrow morning and they're not doing anything. So, you know, that's the politics behind it at the moment. And just to finish, Antrim is where Rathlin Energy are based. They have said they have a massive area there licensed for onshore drilling. They're pretty much letting on to people that they're not going to be fracking, that they're just doing exploratory work. So literally in the next number of months, we reckon we're going to see the industry go in under Rathlin Energy in Antrim, and the residents of Rathlin Basin have set up a Facebook page. They have lobbied their councillors. I just heard today that 30 councillors have said they're totally against fracking. So it's a very similar situation. On the ground, the local councillors are saying again there that they're totally against it, but yet they're being ignored as well by the government. And as I say, Sinn Féin could stop it tomorrow morning. The unionists could stop it tomorrow morning. But it's really, you know, the unionists haven't called for a ban. Sinn Féin have. So they're playing serious politics with this. So it's all at play in Northern Ireland, and that's where we're going to have to focus for the next year, because, as I say, we're waiting for our EPA report. So that's where who we'll be working with and focusing on. Okay.
Thanks very much, Leah. Can I just check, are you speaking at another event today?
Yeah.
Oh, you are, okay. Mm. That's the one at...
That's at 2 o'clock.
Yes, yeah, so Leah will also be speaking today at 2 o'clock in the theatre. The event is titled Priceless Land Resisting Displacement mm-hmm. in Colombia. excuse me. Great, so you'll have a chance to ask Leah some more questions a bit later on. And I'll go straight on to our second speaker. Eric Burke is a member of No Fracking Dublin. Take it away, Eric.
Okay.
Can everyone hear?
Yeah. Great.
So today we're talking about growth, economic growth. Let's be clear what we mean when we refer to growth. It's the growth of capital or economy expanding, but that usually means more and more private profits for the very few elite overlords. It doesn't refer to anything useful to society beyond that, such as more schools, better education or health or anything like that. It just means the growth of money and the richer getting richer. Quite a bit of this self-justifying end comes from incredibly lucrative business of hydrocarbon extraction, a business which by its very nature pollutes water sources, contributes to climate change, both by escape of methane and carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases at extraction, and by the burning of those collected fuels at a later stage in a process of hydrocarbon dependence, which is killing us and warming our world very dangerously. So we in the anti-fracking groups have convened to take action against the massive and extremely profitable corporations that have huge financial interests in continuing this literally explosive and deadly dependence of all humans on hydrocarbons. Hydraulic fracturing will directly damage the local and general environment if it is allowed to go ahead, by leaking greenhouse gases directly at source, as well as the inevitable spills of wastewater containing some carcinogens, such as 2-butoxyethanol. Just real quick, there's the direct damage from fracking, which is, as Leah was talking about, the wastewater, which in theory is supposed to be recycled when it comes back up, but in reality, in say for the States, is one place where it's been done an awful lot up until now. There have been literally thousands of spills
accidents, you know. Well, I'm sure they were accidents, but that's, you know, these are spills, they're going to happen, you know. We was having a debate a while ago with one professor who was employed by the Irish Geology Society, that it can be dangerous, but we can regulate this, we can get it all absolutely perfect. But, you know, the record, like, in Ireland has it even worse, I think, as far as I understand, regulatory record than the United States when it comes to anything involving oil and gas. So if they have thousands of spills, I don't see how we're going to fare any better. Fracking also represents, and it will enable as well, our continued dependence on a fuel which is dramatically warming the world at exactly the moment we can see the massive damage it is being done and will continue to be done. Even if we stopped hydrocarbon burning tomorrow, the Earth will still continue to warm because of feedback. Extreme weather events are now 10 times more likely than they were 50 to 60 years ago. People have been killed in hurricanes and other events that are going to be far more common from now on. We may not have an inhabitable Earth in a century or two, or maybe even less, because any of the predictions that were made about climate change, what turned out to be the reality was the most pessimistic views in the past. Our survival is at stake. So what are we going to do about it? I don't have a very specific answer to this or any kind of theory whatsoever, but what I do intend to do is to establish some basic and fairly obvious facts and sketch out whatever obvious conclusions can be drawn from those. I'll end up saying that the task is impossible without an end to inequality between humans. And regardless, it's indecent to want environmental protection and not socialism. Socialists should be environmentalists and vice versa. The only reason that there is any distance between the two is that humans have long deceived themselves that nature is this kind of outside other, and not to realise actually we exist inside, we are ecology in fact. Even if the ecology that we're existing inside right now is very broken and sick, it's still the case. So to start at an obvious point, let's identify some of the main direct causes of anthropogenic climate change. One obvious thing that we'll need to make happen is an end to an output of greenhouse gases from human activity. Burning hydrocarbons in vehicles, incinerators, factory farms especially. I think factory farms is actually the single greatest contributor as far as I know. Usually in any mainstream discourse that dares to get anywhere near the subject, this is where renewables appear. But this is not the right starting point, even though renewables are important. The problem is not that we have a massive energy demand that we need to find an alternative supplier for. The problem is that we have a massive energy demand. Luckily, world population is evening out, but still, there are billions of us. So we can't afford to have everyone in the world consuming as much energy as the Eurocentric nations have been up until this point. At the same time, I'm not calling for any kind of pain to be inflicted on poor people either, in any part of the world. The very problem is that human life, as it is configured at the moment, necessitates immense waste and destruction. It is not sustainable for us to continue to burn hydrocarbons to commute, for example, large distances every day. To have an abominable monocrop food production system that is specifically designed to make obscene profits for a handful of people that you're never even going to meet. The starting point is our collective energy needs need to come down dramatically. So, for example, and just to take the principle from this, it's just one small example. It's not realistic for us to continue to keep commuting 40 to 50 kilometres to work every day. So obviously a tremendous amount of economy, for example, will need to be shifted out of highly concentrated cities into areas where people can live where they want to live and also get to those areas by a small distance, say by cycling or by public transport or something along those lines. It could also be possible for everyone to move back closer to the centralised cities and commute from there, but somehow this seems either less desirable or perhaps less realistic to have everyone on top of each other. I'm not exactly sure of the answer to that, but these are the kind of things we need to be talking about. Also, there's far too much energy required by the extremely unnatural process of monocrop food cultivation. This is where the principle of permaculture can and should be taken as inspiration for sustainable food production, and even the principle from that can be extended to energy production generally. It's also where we can start to look at the next point, which is sustainable energy production. In permaculture, as in ecology generally, there is no waste. There's only output from one process, which is then the input to another complementary process. So animal waste, for example, feeds the ground, which then produces vegetation, which feeds animals again, and also converts carbon dioxide back to oxygen, which is their waste. Oxygen is our fuel, which we produce carbon dioxide, which is our waste, but that's food for the vegetation also, which also reminds me of one of the main causes of climate change is deforestation. So, you know, that we also need massive reforestation also. There's no reason that all of this can't be used for inspiration in the development of new technologies and processes of human energy production. Primitivists may disagree, but the placing of technology and environmentalism against each other as enemies somehow is as artificial as it is meaningless. There's no reason that we can't simply see a modern process of energy extraction as being technologically flawed and substituted for another modern energy production and use model which has balanced inputs and outputs and has no net waste. There's no reason that we can't design technology and modern processes that are inspired by nature, by ecology, which we actually are, whether we realise it or not, and that fit harmoniously with it. But of course, implementing all of this means acting in exactly the opposite interest of violently and perpetually expanding capital. To really save ourselves, we need to defeat the Shells, BP's General Electrics of the world. And of course, the only way to defeat them is by direct action. The only way to stem the tide. I mean, we've seen that from, for example, the Shell to Sea campaign. We were never going to like be able to try to stem the flow of what was going to happen there by the official processes. They were slowed down by an extremely long time and stopped for an extremely long time by direct action. If we are to replace cancerous economic growth with energy production and use that is only a fraction of what it previously was, which spells less profits to be made, of course. If we are to replace the profitable production of mind-boggling amounts of one food with permaculture, which does produce much food, but of various different types, which naturally makes it less conducive to profit, the only way to implement that is to allocate to each according only to their needs. To replace the legal imperative of corporations to maximise profits with the legal imperative of all society to meet the basic needs of every person that constitutes that society. In other words, socialism. And anarchism, because as long as humans have power over one another, those basic needs can never be met. Illegitimate power only ever seeks to retain its unearned advantage. So, basically, I see hydraulic fracturing. There's the direct damage of hydraulic fracturing, which Lee has talked about. There's the spill, the carcinogenic chemicals going to the atmosphere. As I mentioned, greenhouse gas is going directly into the atmosphere and then later being burned in a hydrocarbon dependence, which is going to kill us. I also see it as, because easily accessible oil and gas is now gone, but there's still plenty of oil and gas that exists, it's just harder to access. So hydraulic fracturing, kind of, it's been around for a long time, but now is the time that it's being expanded for these reasons. So it's kind of the next frontier in a struggle against, a struggle to basically replace hydrocarbons with something that's actually sustainable and doesn't have net waste, won't warm the world. So that's why I'm here. That's why I'm a part of the No Fracking Dublin group. That's why we are opposing fracking, basically. I see the need to develop social organisations with distributed decision-making structures, which can challenge the state in performance of certain functions, like setting collective rules, redistribution of resources, etc., while simultaneously directly with direct action challenging those hydrocarbon based corporations to directly stem the flow of greenhouse gases into the air and symbolically to sound a death knell for the dirty hydrocarbon fuel source. Thanks.
Great, thanks very much, Eric. And you mentioned there towards the end why you're involved in campaign against fracking. People would probably be interested to know how they can get involved. So I suppose I could say first that I understand there's a table downstairs in the books in the basement where all the book stalls are. There's a table. Is it the No Fracking Dublin?
Yeah.
No Fracking Dublin has a stall down there. Leah, I don't know if you want to say anything else about how people can get involved.
Yeah. Obviously No Fracking Dublin. Anyone who's based here in Dublin. Please join them, and you can also give me your name or go online to www. Can't believe I just said that www.frackingfreeireland.org. frackingfreeireland.org. And you can put your name in for the mailing list, and you'll find out from that website about what's going on in the north, what's going on in the south, and also what's going on in the UK. And then there's several Facebook pages, a kind of network page that we use is No Fracking Ireland, and we try and kind of share what's going on in the UK and the US and around the country as well. So No Fracking Ireland on Facebook, No Fracking Dublin's on Facebook as well, and frackingfreeireland.org. And you can download, you know, lots of material from there as well. And anyone who wants badges and things like that, just let them know and they'll send it on to you.
Thanks very much.
No Fracking Dublin meets on the first Tuesday of each month in Shomer Spree. So you can get more information from the stall downstairs. Talk to us.
Great, thanks very much. Okay, our third and final speaker is Paul Bowman. He's a member of the Workers' Solidarity Movement. I'm not going to try and summarise his talk, but there's an article related to it in the latest issue of the Irish Anarchist Review, which is freely available here at the book fair. And it's about degrowth, generally, but if you'd like to take away Paul for 15 minutes.
Yeah, okay. I'm also on the editorial committee of this thing, so I'm also going to point out that as well as my own article, which I'm going to try not to repeat too much of here, there is also an article on, let me find the title of it, on fracking, which, again, I would encourage people to have a look at, as well as the various Facebook and website pages that Les mentioned. I also noticed that when we started, I asked how many people had seen the film Gaslands, and a lot of people hadn't. That's freely available online as well, and is very, I highly recommend watching that. Okay, so I'm not really going to talk about fracking. I'm going to talk about addressing the question that I started with in this article and that I got from my friend and comrade Kat Friedrich here. In February, we were talking about something or other and said, what you're working on, saying, I'm working on this stuff around growth and alternatives to capitalist economic growth. And she said, yeah, why are the left so shit on this? And it's that's kind of my topic. You know, how come we find, you know, in the broadest possible sense, the anti-capitalist movement seems to be divided between lefties and ecologists? You know, what's the source of this? This divide, and how can we get over it? So the title of my talk, I guess, is Neither Keynes Nor Malthus for Liberatory Egalitarian Revolutionary Transition Movement. So the first word I'm going to introduce is this idea of productivism, which is the idea that basically more production is necessarily good, which has obviously is a core value for capitalism, but it's also quite commonly found on the left as well. Worryingly so, in fact. I mean, we have the legacy of Stalinism, the five-year plans, the glorious development of the forces of production, etc. But I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. It's still a bit mysterious why the left has tended historically to be very pro-growth in a quite uncritical way. Because if you think about the next two sort of concepts I'm going to introduce is this idea of techno-optimism, which is the idea, again, very much core capitalist value, that any of the problems that we're going to have, sure, technology will come along, and the clever guys and the white coats will fix it all for us, and we'll have carbon capture and storage. Yeah, right. But this whole idea of if technology is going to fix it all, don't worry, be happy. Obviously, the other side of that is the side that actually we're not convinced that this is a technological problem. We don't think it's a technical problem. We don't think there's a technological fix to this problem because the problem itself is more to do with how our society works. And that would be the techno-pessimist problem angle. Now, the interesting thing is the left should actually be techno-pessimist because the left has always had capitalism has internal problems, internal contradictions. This idea that it can keep growing forever without problems is something we completely oppose. So that mystery is still there. Why is this divide between the left and the ecological movement? And part of that, I'm going to say, is this problem of seeing, sorry if I need a bit of water there, seeing our current problems in terms of under-consumptionism or over-consumptionism. Now, by under-consumptionism, I mean the sort of standard Keynesian, if you like, problem that, like, you know, austerity, unemployment, etc. What we need is a redistribution, tax the rich, use the money to employ the unemployed, you know, everyone gets jobs, people can buy things, makes the economy grow, and working class people get better as the economy grows. So that's under-consumptionism. To say that the problem of economic stagnation, etc., is that basically working class people haven't got enough money to buy the things to make the economy go around. And the overconsumptionism is from, you know, within various tendencies within ecological movements, like degrowth, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, saying that essentially, you know, our overuse of the world's resources, our pollution, our the unsustainable nature of what we're doing from an ecological point of view is a problem of overconsumption. People want too many iPads, they want too many flat screen TVs, they want too many big cars, etc. So it's, you know, it's sort of human greed, if you like, is the source of the issue. Now, obviously, if you have a position of choosing one of either overconsumptionism or underconsumptionism, then there is a, like, an unbridgeable gap there. However, what I'm going to say is that we don't have to come and bring ideas from the outside to fix that, because within both tendencies, there's also a recognition that this is not the whole story. So actually, a lot of the left, for example, if you push them into a corner, go like, of course we're not under consumptionists, because they know, in theory, they're not supposed to be under consumptionists. Many of them may not know why they're not supposed to be under consumptionists, but they've been told they're not under consumptionists. That's the other guys over there. And again, a lot of the ecological movement, again, if you push them in the corner, go like, well, you know, we've, you know, humanity's been around for hundreds of thousands of years. Why are we suddenly destroying the environment so quickly now? They go like, well, yeah, obviously, some the capitalism has something to do with it. So within both tendencies, across this divide, there are already internally the ideas that we need to sort of get beyond this this impasse, if you like. So. I'm not going to go too far on, much further on diagnosing sort of, you know, why the left is on the wrong side of this issue, if you like. I'm not going to say too, well, I'm going to say a little bit about sort of why the general under-consumptionism thing is so powerful at the moment amongst the left side of the anti-capitalist movement, which is, for those of you who lived in Dublin, for example, you'll have seen our local Socialist Party MEP has posters all over the place saying €11 minimum wage on Lord's Wards, €13 minimum wage. But the question, of course, from our point of view is, like, why are there no posters saying, like, we should be working less for the same amount of money? So, and that's, why is there this failure of imagination? Why is sort of the default position of the left under the pressure of the economic collapse and stagnation is to fall back on basic Keynesian policies, despite the fact most of them would swear blind they're not Keynesianisms, but, you know, they're really true revolutionary Leninists or whatever. But when it comes down to the crunch, when it comes to fighting in elections, they demand jobs and growth, like the little Duracell bunny. I think there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is it's a lot easier from an electoral point of view to knock on the doors and go like, yeah, we need jobs and growth, because that's what everybody says. So if everybody says it, then it's very hard for people to disagree with you. I think there are deeper reasons as well, which are to do with the idea that, you know, people's experience of not having enough, poverty, essentially, you know. Irish kids are going to school hungry. They can't pay attention to classes because, you know, they haven't had their breakfast. So, it, you know, people's idea, if you come to them and go like, we're producing too much, we're consuming too much, we need to reduce production, they go, are you kidding me? So this is, again, a reason why it's much easier to say that, okay, whatever about the future and getting over capitalism and sustainable technology, etc. What we need right now is jobs and growth and more money. So I don't think, you know, we should be too quick to condemn people sort of talking those politics, because, you know, they are important politics when you're talking to working class people. You can't just come up to them and go like, you're consuming too much, because that is not their experience today. I know now. The question then becomes about consumption. So if the problem isn't simply underconsumption versus overconsumptionism, then there's obviously something about what we understand around consumption that's wrong. And that's basically this, which is that the dominant sort of capitalist ideology is that the patterns of consumption that we have today are a natural result of people's needs and desires. That's to say, like, capitalism doesn't exist, almost, if you like, in terms of how patterns of consumption are laid down. So we live in a perfectly free society where the existing patterns of consumption are simply, you know, what people choose through market choice. This is obviously wrong. The way we consume, for example, for those of us who are not unemployed, is strongly shaped by having to work for 40 hours a day. You know, those ridiculously...
A week.
A day. My capitalist fantasy is getting ahead of me. So this problem, the problem at the moment is that consumption patterns are reduced down to the single line of less or more. So obviously when you're going out talking to people, you know, if the only question about consumption is either less or more, then the only pro-working class demand is more, more, more. But we have to talk a slightly different type of politics and go like, no, there's another dimensions to patterns of consumption. The patterns of consumption, as Eric was talking about earlier, that we have at the moment that we're forced into because things are so commoditized or individualized. You know, we don't have free public transport. We don't have free taxis to bring the shopping back from the supermarket, etc. People are forced into having cars and stuff like that by this marketization of everything. The patterns of consumption that we have are not a natural result of people's needs and desires. They're shaped by the relations of capitalism. So the other side thing that needs to be mentioned is the degrowth tendency, which obviously I've been having a little bit of look at, and I'm running a little short of time here. And what, first of all, I'd have to say, this is this tendency starting in France. It has a number of people who have been doing a lot of research and intellectual work and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to be able to do it justice here. I have not yet read all of their material, etc. But I am relying heavily on the sort of critique of some of our French anarchist comrades from the Gardie Nationale des Groupes Anarchistes, the CGA, from their recent position paper, where they looked at degrowth because obviously it's part of the environment that they're active within in France. And for all of, there are a lot of interesting things in degrowth tendency, and there are people that are quite close to our politics, but there are also other problems as well, which is what we would call Malthusianism, which is, in some ways, is the opposite side of what we were talking about before with the problem of consumption, which is this idea that essentially the relations of capitalism are not really having any effect on people's patterns of consumption, that the problem is simply overconsumption. The other side of which is that the problem of resource overuse, etc., is posed in some ways as a technical problem. So there's no, you know, they say we have to reduce this, this, and this, and we just have to do it. And there's no question of like, well, do we need social change or whatever? It's like, you know, is this compatible? The objection that the CGA raised to the degrowth program in France is that it's compatible with a conservative politics, with a fascist politics, whatever, because it makes no specification of what kind of politics a sustainable future would look like. And the problem is, if you start from a position that people are consuming too much because of their natural patterns of consumption, then you go, okay, well, if they're not going to consume less voluntarily, then we're going to have to make them. That's an authoritarian solution. So by having this lack of critical sort of picture of how capitalism shapes our existing consumption patterns, and just seeing it as a technical problem, you do by default fall into an authoritarian politics. So hopefully that will, obviously I could talk a lot more, but I think probably that I'm going to leave it to the question and answers and a little bit of discussion, and hopefully I've given you enough to have some things about. Yeah, so in terms of demands, obviously the WSM has been on a journey. I know that sounds like conference talk. but, you know, we started in our involvement in Shell to Sea, for example, which I think William's going to talk about a little bit in a minute. We took up certain positions, which now, on reflection, a few years down the line, we think probably we need to rethink those positions. So where we're going is changing, and we certainly haven't finished where we're going. So, you know, like, the articles in here are by definitely no means are the start of where we're going, not the end position. And finally, I'd say in terms of trying to overcome the existing division between lefties and ecologists within the anti-capitalist movement, I think we need to accept that none of us have all of the answers right yet, and that we need to dialogue in a respectful way and in ways that start from a position of good faith, in terms of not immediately jumping down people's throats and go like, well, you said this, therefore that means you're an XYZ, blah, 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 which unfortunately is a little bit of a tendency of always thinking the worst about the other person, that we have a little bit too much of our thing. So I'll shut it down. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Paul. Three very interesting talks, lots of food for thought there. And thanks also the three of you for being very punctual. And the day is, apparently, I'm told, going to be very punctual, so the next session will start at 12:30. So we're going to try and wrap this up at 20 past 12, give you 10 minutes to just have a break. So that gives us just under 30 minutes more for this session. And I'm going to throw it open to the floor in a minute. Ed?
Yeah, I had a comment / question for Paul. Paul, you kind of went in briefly into, you know, the dynamic between giving workers compensation and wages and giving it to them in time. And I think I propose one of the reasons whereby the left is so confused about growth is this obsession with full employment. And I wonder, I guess it's a question about that. I wonder, do you see a change happening? You're talking about having a journey. I'm here representing basic income, and I'll briefly explain that, which is basically instead of a social welfare system, we give everybody a certain amount of money, and we go to a paradigm of makers and takers towards a paradigm of everybody being able to, everybody is the economy, everybody is society. And it's like, the idea is, some people describe it in terms of a right that hasn't existed yet. But we've got this capitalist system, everything has to be bought, access to so many things are through money, and yet we don't provide people with the means to do that. So one of the problems with getting the left and the unions on board with basic income is that they think their power resides purely in a 40-hour working week. They don't see it existing in a more decentralized system. And that, to me, at least in terms of the old left, seems the biggest problem in kind of moving beyond this growth.
Okay, well, I'll just, before I let Paul, I'll see if there if anyone wants to make any other questions or comments. Yeah.
Yeah, my name is Petter, I'm from Norway. I have a question to Leah. Thanks for very inspiring talks, everybody. You mentioned the threat from, I don't remember who it was, but in this case where a company can lose, you know, future profits, and we know that this are taking more and more into, like, trade agreements and stuff. So just, for example, in Germany, the Swedish company Vattenfall is suing the German state for posing a ban on nuclear plants. So they're suing the German state for 3.7 billion euros because it damages future profits. So I'm just wondering if Ireland has any bilateral investment agreements with other countries that has this future profits clue or something, or if anyone has any knowledge to this new free trade and investment agreement between the EU and the US, which is having this state investor relationship where the investor can be, it's just a way to protect the investor from politics, basically. So I think that was interesting, and I'd like to hear more about that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Does anyone else want to come in at this point? Yep.
I just want to ask about the role of propaganda and propaganda wars in trying to kind of sell fracking and growth and capitalism and all that. Because it's currently at the moment the Ukrainian crisis. It's now, oh, we must bring in fracked shale gas from the United States. But it's almost like a jumping, seizing the opportunity to say, oh, not Mr. Putin. You people in Europe should be saved from having to take gas from Russia. And it's almost like they've been waiting for an opportunity like this to jump in and sell fracked gas. Because I think it's been too cheap to sell up to this point, so they've actually kept it in big containers. But there seems to be a hell of a lot of propaganda. And one of the propaganda motifs that I'm seeing quite a bit is we need energy independence. So you hear David Cameron justifying the reason to frack 2 days out of the UK, because it's energy independence from Russia. But this is never an issue when it's Saudi Arabia, when it's providing oil and gas. So I'm not an expert, but I would also like to echo the points that the two people made comments. I think the transatlantic agreement, and especially the investor state dispute resolution mechanism, is something everyone should be talking about. And everyone who cares about the environment, the workers' rights, the labor rights, you know, we need to know about this. There is a consultation that's been opened, but apparently it's a bit of a, you know, you're pushed into filling out a consultation form or providing a consultation form. But it does seem to be, you've got 90 minutes, the advice is don't mow it, take your time with it, but it is kind of a little bit framed for you. And that's something else we see, is a lot of framing of questions and framing of debates in the media, rather than a lot more, you know, scope to jump out of these frames that are set for us. So, but the basic income thing is another thing from the left. I think it's a fantastic idea. I think it's an idea that's transformed. We're just not hearing about that. So, shut up now.
Right, thanks very much. Let's pick a question over here.
Just following on a bit from the last couple of comments, there is no discourse on fracking in the North at the moment, but it's intermingling with another discourse, which is austerity and welfare reform, which is going to be massive in the North, and it's coming from Westminster. So part of the problem is that fracking is seen as a way of producing economic growth or contributing to the economy at a time where we are being severely hampered by directives from Westminster. And so I'm just wondering how this is going to shape the activities of anti-fracking groups and how we can sort of take on board that, because at the end of the day, people's welfare and pockets are going to be severely hit by this.
Great, thanks. Okay, I might go back to the speakers if you want to respond to that. I'll ask you to try and keep it to about 3 minutes each, if possible. I know there's a few things. Well, I don't know, or perhaps let's go over a little bit. There doesn't seem to be a huge show of hands, so give a little bit of leeway. Well, Paul, if you are out of mind, your question, somebody answer your question there first.
Or we just take it in order.
Well, maybe, sorry, actually, I should take it in the order that we... Leah, if you'd like to respond to those, thanks.
The transatlantic trade agreement. George Monbiot has written quite a bit about this in the Guardian newspaper, and I completely agree with him. I mean, the transatlantic trade agreement will, once pushed ahead, will basically, for the first time between European countries and Canada and North America, will really copper fasten corporate rule and corporate, law, superseding local governments, national governments, the European government. So, for example, Southwest Energy in the States, who have been fracking all over North America, they also got licensed to start fracking in Canada. in areas of Canada, there's massive resistance against it. The people of the First Nations are up in arms against fracking. And of course, because of the Keystone XL pipeline as well, and tar sands, you know, there's a lot of activity going on against extreme energy policies in Canada. So they got their government, federal government, in a part of Canada to not allow Southwestern Energy to go ahead. Southwestern Energy are now suing the Canadian authorities because of that. And that's exactly the future of under the Transatlantic Trade Agreement that we're going to see if it's been allowed. And as George Monbiot was talking about, he was basically saying that, you know, this is something that if it's allowed, go ahead, and it's not been spoken about and it's not been dealt with at all in our media. Nobody knows about this. But it basically will mean as well that if, like through our local government, and we uphold that ban in Leitrim County Council. And I thought it was very strange at the time when I was saying that the county manager said, you know, that these politicians would personally incur. I thought, where did he get that from? Where is that coming from? And that was directly given to him from the Department of Energy, I would say, and Natural Resources. That, you know, and it was like the Transatlantic Trade Agreement, like in small scale Leitrim Trade Agreement. You know what I mean? That's exactly what they were doing. They were using the same language and the same tactics. So yeah, it's really frightening. It's an outrageous situation, and the only person I've seen speaking about it in the media has been George Monbiot. There's loads of campaign sites online as well about it for people to get involved and sign petitions and all of that. But it's directly being pushed for the energy sector. That's what it's about. With regards to propaganda and media, you know, since we started this campaign 3 years ago, we have been screaming from the rooftops to try and get some sort of coverage on this issue. RTE have given us the usual 5 minutes here and there at a time. It's pretty much a serious censorship going on with regards to fracking in the country. Our local papers have been pretty good. Radio stations, but now we see a clampdown by them as well. We had Greg Palast here, just as an example. He had just written his book, someone remember that? Vulture's Picnic, and he was here kind of promoting that. And we got him on to News Talk with, not News Talk, is it News Talk?
Yeah, no, Today FM.
Today FM. Matt Cooper, that's right. Brought him into the radio station. He had a good lengthy interview with Matt Cooper.
Pre-recorded.
It was to go out at 6 p.m. that day. We were sitting around listening, waiting for it, and nothing happened. Contacted the radio station, and the producer said that there were legal issues with what Mr. Palast had said. And we said, what were the legal issues? And he said, well, it was to do with what he said about Lord Brown, who is the CEO of Quadrilla, former CEO of BP. And he said it was to do with his comments, and we said, Bush, that's ridiculous. He has printed what he has said about Lord Brown in his book, which is on sale in shops. So what are you talking about? So they pulled the piece, like, and that is just, you know, one example of several. We've had speakers over from Canada, a woman who used to work in the industry, is now suing the industry because her water on her land is contaminated. She has to buy in water. Her land is contaminated. And she was absolutely point blank, just refused any airtime as well. We had another woman from Australia where anti-fracking campaign is huge in Australia. And it's called the Lock the Gate campaign. And anyone should look them up because they're really inspirational. And she was refused airtime. So, I mean, it's ferocious what they're doing. And we can't understand that, you know, if something as big as this, there's no national debate, and there is massive non-violent direct action going on in the UK with regards to this, but yet we're in this kind of bubble here. We're not even talking about the fact that that's going on over there. Naomi Klein has written a very good article about the situation with Ukraine and natural gas, and it's online at the minute. She only wrote it a couple of days ago. It's really good, and she explains why this is, you know, it's shock doctrine politics, and how basically that the the energy sector are using this. There's a crisis. It's fantastic, though, because we've all this natural gas in the US that we can export to Europe, and we don't have to deal with nasty Mr. Putin anymore. So you should check it out, Naomi Klein. It's in
on
the Guardian.
Website.
Say again?
Is it on our website?
No, it's in the Guardian newspaper.
Right,
yeah.
Thanks,
Leah. Okay, Paul, if we say 5 minutes.
But I'm not next.
Oh, no, well...
I wasn't asked any questions.
I said, well, do you want to come back in?
Not really, no.
Sorry, sorry, no, it's just based on questions that we put.
All right.
If you want to later.
No.
Can't do. Okay, so, Paul.
All right, I'll just set me a little... I've become addicted to this stopwatch thing. It's the only way I can stop talking. Yeah, I'm actually... I'll come right to your question because it's a direct question to me, but first I'm going to jump in this one about the threat from the council executive to sue for loss of earnings. And I want to make the connection with Aer Lingus. As you may or may not know, recently the workers at Dublin Airport in SIPTU Union, we're in a SIPTU building, but I have to say I'm a member of the Independent Workers Union, so I'm not a cheerleader for SIPTU, but we support them on this. Balloted for industrial action just before St. Patrick's Day, and they did so under the terms of the 1990 Industrial Relations Act, which is supposed to say that if you follow all of these rules, and believe me, they're really fucking restrictive, then you can have a legal strike and you're protected from being sued. Guess what? First of all, they got an injunction to prevent the strike on the grounds that it was the wrong time of year, the airport would lose too much money. Then, now they're suing the union for a strike that didn't even fucking happen. And this is, which is coming back to, this is a general tactic. We're actually seeing this all over the place now. In Ireland, they think it's a wonderful idea. There's a thing about the propaganda as well, using threats of lawsuits to get stuff pulled. Didn't work too well for Panty Bliss, thank God. Hey. But, you know, we have to be aware that they are trying to go like, okay, we put all this austerity on, people, you know, sort of in the IMF are going, there's going to be riots in the streets, like, they haven't rioted. Great, let's fucking do them, you know, let's make everything illegal. Any sign of opposition, we'll sue the arse off them. Well, part of me thinks it's outrageous. The anarchist part of me goes like, okay, you want to force it into illegality? Fucking bring it on. Because I think they're making a mistake when they do that. But anyway. So, I just wanted to make that Aer Lingus connection there. Getting back to basic income, I'm glad you asked me that question because that's a section of my talk that I actually skipped over. I agree, it's an interesting sort of transitional demand, but without rent controls, for example, if we got basic income, they just put the rent up and it would just go straight in one pocket and out the other. So on its own, it doesn't provide us with what we're interested in, the idea behind basic income, if you like, which is to actually have our own reproduction guaranteed and then work to be an optional and extra, people actually being able to choose what they do and choose how they use their time. So there is the problem of rent controls. There is also the difficulty, and this is my trad sort of Marxist hat on, is that it's a measure around distribution, and it doesn't do anything about who controls production, who controls the land, what's under the land, what's on top of the land, and all the rest of it. So I think it's an interesting demand for getting people to think around, you know, sort of why are we stuck on this treadmill of having to sell our lifetimes for a pittance. But I don't think on its own it will radically change without addressing those two issues, A, the problem of the rent, and B, the problem of control over the land and means production. is there another thing? Yeah, that was Peter's question, the lost suing for lost profits. It appears to be a European-wide strategy as well. Not just in Ireland. And certainly, I think there's some signs that because of this transatlantic trade agreement thing, there will be more of it. The propaganda question, I think, nearly out of time. Propaganda question, yes. And that brings us back to Eric's point. The way the debate is framed is it's all about energy supply. There's no question about energy demand. Recently in the UK, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has said, you know, was reporting as saying, we've got to get rid of all this green crap, meaning the taxes on energy bills that were actually earmarks of ring fence to be being spent on energy saving and heating saving devices in old people's homes. So this is like all of that stuff about demand management, fuck it. You know, so again, that's that propaganda thing, the framing of it as a crisis of supply rather than questioning what's behind the demand is something that we really need to push back on. And finally, the framing of the debate in Northern Ireland about, you know, austerity, jobs and growth is the answer. Yeah, that's entirely the core of what we're trying to do in terms of pushing that debate back and saying, you know, hang on, why? The difficulty is this. Yes, there is a way to get back to full employment, but that's only if we increase what everyone's consuming. In other words, if we do more capitalism faster, more growth faster, we're going to destroy the planet faster. So, you know, at a certain stage, and I think we have already reached that stage, we need to go, hang on, we can't keep going this direction. And I agree it's difficult because then we have to challenge the whole way the debate is framed around economic growth. But I don't think there's no stage of solution to that. That's not something that we can do. Like, first we need to look after working class people's material needs, then we can address these issues. I think these issues are on top of us. We're going to have to, they're not separate issues, they're connected, and we're going to have to try and win the argument about how those issues are connected.
Thanks, Paul.
Could I get a show of hands of anyone else who wants to come in again? Okay, we have two, three there. With apologies since I'm the facilitator, but I'm going to just take Eric's time for a couple of minutes because we discussed this at the start that I might say something about the Carb Gas Project and Ireland's oil and gas generally in relation to climate change. And just time myself there. Paul made a reference to posters and asking why are posters from, you know, left parties of the left not calling for less work for the same pay, for example. And I guess the problem is that that's difficult electorally, and it just steps so far outside of the consensus and so on. But an analogy would be in relation to the Carb Gas Project. As I'm sure you know, Shell to Sea and the other campaigns in North Mayo against the Carb Gas Project have never called, well, have generally not, their demand has not been for the gas to be left in the ground. And more generally, it has not been for Ireland's oil and gas, because, you know, Shell to Sea and people campaigning on Carb have campaigned more generally about Ireland's ownership of Ireland's oil and gas and licensing terms, as I'm sure you know, everyone who knows. You know, there's a huge issue around the fact that ownership and control of Ireland's oil and gas is transferred to the company that finds it, and Ireland, there are very few benefits to people in Ireland. So, you know, campaigners, we could call for oil and gas to be left in the ground. There's a tension there and a conflict. And if I just take an example, this is something that was brought out about 4 or so years ago by Dublin Shell to Sea. It's called the Sunday Independent. And it went down very well, and a huge number were printed. And it's a sort of, the conceit is, if you like, that it's kind of a news story that Ireland has taken back ownership of its oil and gas. And based on estimates, there's a newer version. This is 420 billion euro, and there's a newer version with 600 billion euro. And what we could spend with that, if Ireland was taking the revenue from that, what we could spend, and there are examples here of, in fact, the list was 375,000 teacher salary, 375,000 times a teacher salary for 40 years. So in other words, think of what we could spend, hospitals and you know, public spending. The problem, obviously, is, you know, the logical kind of implication of that is that the campaign, the leaflet, is calling for Ireland to find and extract and burn its oil and gas as quickly as possible so we can spend it on things that it should be spent on. So there's a real problem there. And there's been a certain debate within, I know, within Chalfacy and that, and in fact, a later, you may prefer this as well, Liquid Assets came out about a year and a half ago, where it has moved considerably, and that approach is sort of gone, and there's quite a lot of references to climate change in the introduction, executive summary, conclusion. There's a whole section on climate change, and basically there was quite a lot of debate. I was involved in one of the people who put this together, and I was also one of the people, I have to admit, but I lay that out and design it, but so I was involved, but in both the earlier version and then this version, which is to say, actually, no, it's, you know, clearly that's problematic. So the approach here is to say, well, actually, you know, there's quite a lot of references to climate change, and saying, not saying necessarily that the gas should be left in the ground. There's a kind of good debate to be had there. You know, actually, should the campaigners just say, actually, no, just leave it in the ground? Whereas the approach is to say, no, the gas should be exploited in a way that's safe, and the ownership should be taken back by people in Ireland. But in relation to climate change, the approach more recently is to say, well, you know, it's the worst of both worlds, because the gas is going to be extracted, gas and oil that should belong to Ireland is going to be extracted, and there are going to be huge carbon emissions and a lot of implications for climate change, and Ireland isn't going to benefit from it either. The profits are all going to go to private companies. So, in fact, the approach would be to say, well, it makes no sense for those decisions about climate change and decisions about how, whether or not we should extract oil and gas and how quickly we should burn it or not, and whether we should leave it in the ground, all those issues about fossil fuels and climate change should be taken by people in Ireland or by their public representatives, depending on your politics. So basically we need to take back control, including over those decisions. I'll go back to the floor. Could you show me the hands again? Maybe I'll bring Kat in next. Yep.
Okay, thanks very much for the great presentations. And it's so cool that someone started to talk about this, I think, because it doesn't happen very much. So I think the left is a mess on the issue, but I think the environmental movement is a bit of a mess as well. I don't think they're doing very well. I think a lot of the environmental movement thinks they're beyond left and right, and they think, you know, they're all just talking about growth, so we're kind of above that, and I think that's a problem as well. And in theory, they should be anti-capitalist, but no one seems to talk about that, so I don't know how they want to move away from growth when they're talking about capitalism. That doesn't really make much sense to me. Then in terms of, like, the groups that make up the environmental movement, I think a lot of them are single issue based, and I was just wondering, maybe some of the people involved in the anti-fracking campaigns, do you see people making connections a lot, or are most people just really focused on the issue, or do people look at the bigger picture as well? Because I think, you know, in organisations like Birdwatch Ireland or something like that, I don't think they have a good analysis about the economic system. They just care about our feathered friends, and that's it. Then I was chatting to someone last weekend about degrowth, and they made an interesting point saying that there's some parts that have to grow, probably, you know, and we probably need to build new infrastructure and things like that. So there might be, for the short term, some things might have to grow and others have to shrink, but what do we include and what, you know, we need to talk about things like GDP in terms of measuring growth and that doesn't make sense as a concept. And so on, but you know, like, what things have to grow and what not, and what's the time frame of those. I suppose I was wondering how we can continue this conversation.
we're running low on time, but was there somebody else back there? I know you, Paul, do you want to come in quickly again? Yeah, sorry, thanks.
And I do think that there is a very massive disconnect, but it needs to be bridged very badly. I mean, people on both sides need to realise that we need the finer points of each
and that no one's going to progress. Like, you know, neither side is going to progress. But people who are like traditional old left, who don't care about the environment, need to realize that needs to be dealt with now, and it needs to be a part of their kind of discourse or whatever. Now, at the same time, environmentalists need to realize that it's not going to be at all possible, even if they don't like humans or whatever stupid stuff. You know, they're not going to get like to replace hydrocarbons and replace environmental destruction without getting people in on it as well. You don't have a choice, basically.
Okay, thanks. Leo wants to just say something for literally 10 seconds.
Anyone who's interested in the economics behind shale gas, Deborah Rogers is the lady's name. She was an advisor to the Obama administration. She visited here. She gave a talk. It's called The Shale Bubble in Wall Street, and she basically says it's akin to the housing bubble and crash that also happened. Massive subsidization going on, massive write-downs from the banks with regards to debt for energy companies, and also with regards to the environment and the left and all the rest. Like, I don't see fracking as just an environmental issue. It's really a human rights issue, and it, for me, symbolizes kind of what's going on with economics, what's going on with, you know, where we're going, growth, degrowth. It really is something that encapsulates all of that. And the Irish Environmental Network, of which Birdwatch is a part of, you know, these people, these NGOs, they really need to shape up. You know, they there's a major problem, and they are part of the problem, okay, in my view.
Okay, thanks. So Paul wants to make a housekeeping point.
Just a housekeeping thing. If you're going to go to other meetings today, they'll be handing out the contact and feedback sheets as well. So you may think, I've already filled one of these out. However, yeah, you don't have to fill a contact figure out, but remember, we need feedback for each meeting. So if I know it's a lot of filling in forms and stuff, it sounds like bureaucratic, and we do recycle. But please, yeah, if you could remember, you know, if you could find it in your hearts to give feedback to the other meetings you go to, that'd be great. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thanks. Thanks all for coming. Great.
This audio is a recording of the session Defeating Fracking, Setting Limits to Growth, from the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in 2014. You'll find more audio from the Anarchist Book Fair at www.wsm.ie/bookfair.